Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on whose land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to acknowledge the elders and also our elders or more recent arrival. Thank you for joining us this morning on Let's Talk, a very special edition. We usually on public holidays, you know, leave Let's Talk out, but, you know, it's being May Day and, you know, I think we should explore the relationship between unions and the Aboriginal movement. It has been, you know, one of the strongest movements in this country when our Aboriginal movement and the union movement come together. And we see, you know, in recent times, you know, when you think of this collaboration in the past, you would think of the Wayfield walk-off, the Pilbara strike, and then I guess also most recently with the First Nations Workers Alliance and the work that they're doing to support, you know, remote community CDP workers, you know, who are getting treated very, very badly. If our listeners would have listened to our program a few days ago, you would have heard my yarn with the deadly Birragubba woman and sister Lara Watson, who was, you know, with many other Aboriginal people heading, you know, this campaign from a grassroots, you know, on boots on the ground level. But my guest this morning, you know, he's not a stranger to Let's Talk, is Paddy Gibson. How you going, brother?
I'm good, bro. Thanks very much for getting me on.
No, that's all good, brother. Just before we start, you know, tell us, you know, who you are and, you know, some of the stuff that you're involved in and yeah.
Yeah, so I'm a non-Indigenous man. I was born in Sydney. It's an Irish Catholic background, you know, that I come from. My family on both sides, been here for many generations, but, you know, held on to that strong sort of Irish Catholic identity through that process. But yeah, I grew up in Sydney, and my family was involved in Aboriginal struggle from when I was quite young. I lived some time when I was young in Wilcannia in far western New South Wales, when my father helped set up the Aboriginal Medical Service there, and they always took me to the land rights marches and stuff like that. So yeah, when I went to university, and I got quite involved in politics myself, doing a lot of protesting around the war in Iraq and what was going on campus. I just sort of gravitated as well towards the protests that were being led by Aboriginal people here in this city and trying to support in whatever way I can. And I've been very lucky over the last 10 years. I've been working at UTS, University of Technology, for about 16 or 17 years, and about half of that time, I've had a part-time position at Jumbunna Research, which is headed up by Larissa Barrett, who's a really, really, really strong Aboriginal scholar and writer and filmmaker. So, you know, I consider that a real privilege to be able to work in this environment alongside and led by some really strong Aboriginal scholars. And in my own time, I do, you know, a lot of organising still of, you know, protest. I'm involved in a socialist group called Solidarity. I edit that magazine. So, you know, not just black protests, but more broadly union struggle and other things. But, you know, a lot of the most meaningful work for me, it really comes out of supporting the struggles of, you know, strong Aboriginal people that are fighting against their kids getting taken away, being killed in custody, etc. You know, I've learned so much from that. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for that, brother. Yeah, you've been involved in quite a bit of stuff in your time, and I didn't realise your old man was helped set up the medical centre at Wilcannia. Oh, yes, so, yeah. So you've been in and around, I guess, Aboriginal politics for quite some time.
Yeah, no, that's right. And really, the formative sort of part of my life, really, you know, has been being involved in that struggle. You know, both here in Sydney, and supporting people here in Sydney, and also some time in the Northern Territory. I lived up there for about 5 years under the opening phase of the Northern Territory intervention. So there was a really strong fight back from community leaders up there in the territory that I was really lucky to be able to stand alongside them, you know, and learn a lot through that process. Yeah.
And definitely, and like, you know, the struggle for the mob up in the Northern Territory still continues in terms of, you know, when we're talking about the Northern Territory interventions, which has been changed to Stronger Futures, and I added another 10 years onto that as well, you know, so the mob, you know, they've always been locked into that battle. And then as of recent times, they want to open it up to, you know, fracking companies, and they want to start, you know, doing other types of mining within the NT as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, Aboriginal people got it hard everywhere, you know. I know that. I know how hard people struggle day to day. In the territory, there's this edge to it, you know, where it's so in your face because of the apartheid regime that exists under the Northern Territory intervention. You know, it's explicit legislation which says Aboriginal people are second-class citizens by virtue of their race. Police have special powers to raid their houses, you know, stop cars, search cars without a warrant. You know, if it's on Aboriginal land, there's all the restrictions on alcohol and pornography, and control of people's income with basic card, all these sorts of things that, you know, mob everywhere lived through with the Protection Era, the Protection Acts. You know, that's back in the Northern Territory in a very, very heavy way. It's obviously back everywhere, you know, people living under a welfare board style regime of docks and Centrelink and housing and all the racism and, you know, controls from the police. But yeah, like, it's really something to witness, that out-and-out open apartheid up there. And as you mentioned there, and the powerful interests that are behind that and that really want to see people smashed and kept down so they can take their land.
Take a look at the sky, there's nothing but dark clouds all around. Take a look in my eyes, my heart, my soul, it can be found. This sacred ground you walk has stories of its own. This sacred ground is sacred ground, it is my home, where my family's blood's been shed. The rest is still unknown. It's not just the government that's doing it all wrong. It's down here on the ground. It's been like that all along. Just a matter of time, baby, we'll all find all that glitters doesn't shine. It's just a matter of time, baby, we'll all find all that glitters doesn't shine. Every mile's just like uphill climbing. Every day is another day. And every night I hear spirits crying. And they just don't go away. Everybody, take a look at the sky. There's nothing but dark clouds all around. Take a look in my eyes, my heart, my soul, it can be found. This sacred ground you walk has stories of its own. This sacred ground is sacred ground, it is my home, where my family's blood's been shed. The rest is still unknown. It's not just the government that's doing it all wrong. It's down here on the ground. It's been like that all along. It's just a matter of time. Maybe we'll all find all that glitters doesn't shine. It's just a matter of time. Maybe we'll all find all that glitters doesn't shine. sky, there's nothing but dark clouds all around. Take a look in my eyes, my heart, my soul, it can be found. This sacred ground you walk has stories of its own. This sacred ground, this sacred ground, it is my home.
You're tuned to Let's Talk, a weekly current affair program hosted by First Nations people for First Nations peoples. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
And if you're just tuning in, my guest is Patty Gibson, researcher from UTS in the Jumbunna Research Unit?
Yes.
Down there in Sydney. One of the reasons why I wanted to get you on is, today being, May Day, everybody, out there marching today. I just wanted to explore the relationship, between union movements and also the Aboriginal movement as well, and it dates back as far as, when we're talking about, like my earliest memories, I remember watching a documentary, I think it was from the, the 60s or the 70s or even maybe before that, it was called How the West Was Lost or Won. And, how these mob, over a vast amount of land, from the different cattle stations and reserves and whatnot, organised, I think, a few months in the lead up, before they're having a strike. And then, it was one of the biggest strikes as well, I believe, in terms of the people and how stretched out the distance between some of the mob. And then, there was obviously, we mentioned before, the way of your walk off as well. From your perspective, how important is that relationship for union members? And also, to know the history of the union movement supporting, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander movements.
Yeah, well, look, it's very central to my whole outlook on the world, really. I'm a socialist. I see the system that we've got at the moment. It's everything's owned and controlled by, a tiny elite who are only concerned with profit. They don't care if they destroy the planet. They're only interested in exploiting people and exploiting resources, and that's what the whole system of government and economy that we have, is set up around. And he's looking for ways to challenge that and looking for ways to fight that. And, I think in this country, that has required a genocide of Aboriginal people to try to destroy the complete alternative way of life that people had, based in their communities. Respect for each other, respect for the land, that needed to be destroyed and to clear people out of the way, to introduce extreme ideologies of racism to justify that process, and the resistance that's come from black people to that has been an insurgent resistance, armed resistance for many, many years, and then, continuing to find ways to struggle and to fight back and to refuse to go quietly in the face of that system. And then, the vast majority of people that are brought here are working class people who are exploited. Their labor is exploited for the system. And part of the power, I think, of the way they maintain their rule is they encourage ideas which keep us divided from each other. And, for so long, they've relied on workers accepting the racist ideas that exist about Aboriginal people. And that's true of the trade union movement as well. For a long, long time and still today, there are many, many union members who just accept the racism they read in the newspaper, see on the television, that they're taught in schools. That's the dominant ideology. That's what they live under. That's what they believe. But that's led to, a disgraceful history in a lot of cases of trade unions seeing Aboriginal people as a threat to their wages and conditions, and trying to keep Aboriginal people out of trade unions. especially in the early part of the 20th century when the White Australia policy ideology was very, very strong, people were seen as a threat, you know. So I do a lot of research into this history. I'm doing a PhD at the moment in history and some of this history to try and understand this process. And, you know, so that's part of it. And then the other part of it, the part that I think we need to pay very close attention to, is the moments in time where those divisions have broken down and where workers have been able to realise that their interests are actually not in maintaining the racism and trying to keep their little privileges over the top of black people. It's by actually standing in solidarity with the mob, you know, standing alongside people, recognising that it's, you know, we're all visitors on Aboriginal land. And, you know, I think that, you know, being able to look at moments in history where those ideas have broken down and where workers have stood, you know, alongside Aboriginal people in struggle, I think, you know, that's the sorts of things it's important to understand, because it shows us the potential, you know, for similar things to happen and for similar things to happen on a much broader scale to actually really challenge, you know, the situation that we are. That we are in. So, yeah, a lot of my research has been looking into some of this. And, yeah, it's interesting when you mentioned May Day and we're doing this interview on May Day, you know, is actually there's been quite a few times when it's been actions around May Day, which is International Workers' Day and is seen as a day of international solidarity and workers' struggle, when that day has been used by black workers to fight against their own extreme oppression and exploitation, and that sort of spirit of internationalism and solidarity has meant that, you know, they have got some support at key times and have been able to build on that support to push back, you know, the oppression that they're under. So, yeah, it's important for me, I think, to look at those moments and understand the potential of those moments.
It definitely is, you know, and I think one of the key moments that, you know, everybody think of, or, you know, like people, seem to think of is, you know, the famous song by Paul Kelly and Uncle Kev Carmody from Little Things That Make Things Grow, you know, with the wave he'll walk off, you know, when Vincent Lingiari came to Sydney, I believe, and, you know, was, you know, meeting, with, doing speaking tours and whatnot with community and trade union members and stuff. You know, I think that's, you know, one of the most widely known in this country, in our country, sort of union solidarity moments with mob and unions. I guess, you know, for our listeners, you know, what are some of the other, you know, solidarity moments, like some of the really staunch and, I guess, you know, things that we need to remember in terms of strengthening that relationship?
Yeah, I think I like looking back right at the sort of early part of where you had a bit of a breakdown in the racist ideas held by groups of non-Indigenous workers, and you saw, you know, black workers really moving, and black communities more generally, you know, moving into struggle with some support, you know, with a bit of backup from organised workers. And one really important time for me, I think, is in Darwin, actually, in the late 1920s, where you had an unemployment crisis, and you know, the white workers in the town of Darwin responded to that unemployment crisis during the Depression by trying to kick all the black workers out of town, you know. So they actually had their union, the main campaign that the union ran at that time for a couple of years, 1928, 1929, was to exclude black workers from town. They would go around and picket different hotels and other workplaces where black labour was being used, and they said, we want white workers to be given the preference in the jobs. And they weren't getting anywhere. Like, you know, this is horrendous racism, but it also wasn't getting anyone any work, you know, like maybe a few people get employed here and there, but it wasn't dealing with the situation. And it was that time when there was a few, like, revolutionary white workers, you know, some people who had just joined the Communist Party of Australia, which was just starting to understand what was going on with Aboriginal people. For many years, they'd been blind themselves, despite being, you know, very radical and anti-racist when it came to, say, Chinese workers in Australia or supporting national liberation struggles overseas, you know, the Chinese revolutionary movement, Indonesian revolutionary movement, they hadn't realised what was going on in this country. But in Darwin in the late 1920s, you actually had a group of them who started to say, this is the wrong approach. We can't be trying to exclude the black workers out of their work sites. We should actually be fighting our own union to allow membership regardless of racial background. And that was a big struggle over a few years, you know, to actually fight to get Aboriginal people to be allowed to join the union. And May Day was used as a point of mobilisation by the radicals. And there were Aboriginal people involved in this, a very, very young Joe McGuinness, who went on to play a really important role in the trade union movement across Northern Australia. He was involved from the late 1920s and early 1930s. And they started to have big demonstrations, multiracial demonstrations, to demand work for everybody and to demand union rights. And that was the real foundation for a lot of the struggles that were to come. You saw a big wave of strikes by black workers in Darwin in the 1940s, again in the 1950s, and then, you know, the history that a lot of people are aware of, the Wayfield walk-off, obviously built on that platform as well. You know, but really early back in the day, the union's position was Aboriginal people couldn't be members. And we should remember that, you know, and remember that it took a fight to overturn that, but that the strength that came from overturning that was a very, very important platform for a lot of the struggles going forward, not just the struggles over wages and conditions, but what became a fight for land and for autonomy and for respect for Aboriginal law and everything else that was bound up in that. Yeah.
In 2012, when we had the embassy set up here in Musgrave Park, we got the call the night before. Well, like we were on call because we knew the cops were coming in, in a space of like 3 to 4 days. We just didn't know which day. So, we were all on edge and it was all waiting. And then we got the phone call and, you know, somebody tipped us off saying they're definitely coming in first thing in the morning. So, you know, we all had a rest and got a couple hours sleep and woke up fresh, and Aunt Coco's telling us, you know, stack the wood and the leaves here because when they come in, you know, chuck us straight on the fire. You know, we want to smoke this whole city out. We want to see, you know, we want all of Brisbane to know that, you know, on this day, May 16th, 2012, you know, they wanted to try to move us out. And, you know, like in the lead up to that there, we were talking and, you know, like we were doing stuff with other unions. And the day before, ETU came down and a few other unions said, oh, you know, like we're here to show our solidarity. What do you need? We go, oh, we need a fence, you know, to keep us, you know, to keep the coppers out. So they, you know, brought us down to live, like,
awesome.
Yeah, literally, you know, within 45, half an hour, there was a truck coming there with fencing. So we all, you know, lined up and put the fence together. And then I think that morning or the next morning, you know, the coppers start lining up and running into the park and surrounding the park, and there were union members that were in there with us, ETU fellas and a couple other union members as well. And then also there was mob union fellas on the outside as well. You know, and like one of the blokes on the outside, I remember one of the TV crews that was filming and the cops saying, stand back, mate, stand back. You know, if you're moving it, move forward again, we'll have to arrest you. He's like, yeah, well, you know, like my brothers and, you know, my union brothers there and they're showing solidarity. And like he just rushed, like walked towards the police. They grabbed him and arrested him.
Wow.
But yeah, you know, like we had, you know, the ETU mob in there with us and some other union members as well. You know, as soon as the coppers come in and started grabbing us, you know, they made sure to like hold their ground, and you know, next thing we know, we're all, you know, in the watch house cells, sitting there together having a laugh, and you know, yeah, you know, like that, yeah, like, yeah, like that's a really, really, you know, fond memory that I have, you know, with that, with the union support as well.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I mean, that's just, you know, such a good example, like the living tradition, you know, that we're discussing and what is possible, you know. And the sad thing is that that's not consistent, you know, it drops away. But we, you know, you can see the possibilities there. I mean, it's, you know, similarly with, you know, the Wayfield strike, you know, it's well known about the Wayfield strike, but a lot of other things are, a lot less known, you know, like, for example, the first mob who went on strike weren't at Wave Hill in that period. It was Newcastle Waters. They went on strike in the Barclay Tableland. They went on strike on the 1st of May to demand equal pay. And the main union that represented the workers at that time, they didn't want the strike to spread because they had a more conservative approach, you know, like, we'll just wait for the arbitration court to give us equal pay. We'll just wait for, like, a Labor government maybe to change the policy. We'll just keep these fellas out on strike as a bit of a symbol, you know, but let's just, you know, that we'll limit it to that. But it was actually black workers themselves and also militants who were willing to push the boundaries of the existing union movement who broke out of that. And you know, Dexter Daniels was one of the organisers who went to Wave Hill and only a few months later went to Wave Hill where he knew that people were wanting to take action. And he had the support of Frank Hardy, who was a Communist Party journalist at that time, who told him, like, if you go out on strike, the main union probably won't support you, but I have good militants that I know all over the country who will support you, you know? And that gave them the confidence. They said, right, you know, we're going out. And then immediately there was a network there that could spring into action through the revolutionary movement. And, you know, and like you said, the speaking tours and everything that came from that is, you know, a very important memory. But also the black unionists in Sydney and on the East Coast were absolutely crucial for that. You know, Kevin Cook was a black organiser with the Builders Labourers Federation. Chica Nixon was a waterside worker at that point in time. On the docks here in Sydney. And so it was people like that who said, you know, we've got to support our brothers and sisters in the north, and we've got to build on the networks we have here in Sydney to make sure that people are supported. You know, people would tithe their wages, so the workers would tithe their wages on a number of work sites to go back to the strike camp, you know. So, I mean, those mob that are sitting in the police cell with you, you know, defending the embassy. Yeah, I think it's up to those of us, you know, who are in the union movement connected to say, well, how can we build on that? How can we work together to make sure that people like yourselves, the struggles that you're putting up, they really do get the support they deserve, you know, because we've got to recognise that, you know, that's the key to the power of these bastards who run this country. You know, is what they've done in terms of the dispossession of your land. So it's important. It's important insight to try to build on.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Gather around, people. I tell you a story, an 8-year-long story. Power and pride, the British Lord Vesty, the Vincent Lingari, were opposite men on opposite sides.
Vesty was fat with money and muscle, beef was his business, broad was his door. Vincent was lean, spoke very little. He had no bank balance, our dirt was his floor.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Gurindji were working, nothing but rations. Once they had gathered the wealth of the land, daily depression got tighter and tighter. Gurindji decided they must make a stand.
They picked up their swags, started off walking at Wadi Creek. They sat themselves down. Now it don't sound like much, but it sure got tongues talking back at the homestead and then in the town.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
say, I'd double your wages, $7 a week you have in your hand. Vincent said, we're not talking about wages, we're sitting right here till we get our land.
Vesty man roared, Vesty man thundered, you don't stand a chance of a cinder in snow. Vincent, if we fall, others arising.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Then Vincent Lingyari, he boarded an airplane, landed in Sydney, big city of lights. Daily he went round, softly speaking his story to all kinds of men from all walks of life.
Vincent sat down with them big politicians. This affair, they told him, it's a matter of state. Let us sort it out. Why your people are hungry? Vincent said, no thanks, we know how to wait.
From little things, big things grow.
Then Vincent Lingyari returned in an airplane back to his country once more to sit down. He told his people, let the stars keep on turning. We have friends in the south, in the cities and towns.
Eight years went by, eight long years of waiting, to one day a tall stranger appeared in the land. And he came with lawyers, came with great ceremony, through Vincent's fingers poured a handful of sand.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. That was the story of Vincent Lingyari. This is the story of something much more. Our power and privilege cannot move a people who know where they stand. Standing there long. From little things, big things grow. 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 From little things, big things grow.
Tune to Let's Talk, a weekly current affair program hosted by First Nations people for First Nations peoples. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
And if you're just tuning in, my guest is Patty Gibson, researcher from UTS in the Jumbunna Research Unit down there in Sydney. I believe that the mob involved in the day of mourning in 1938, didn't they? I think it was them or some mob before them.
Yeah.
Had literature from Marcus Garvey, because some of their mob used to work in the wharfs. And like the Black Star Fleet would, would drop some stuff off, or, you know, come through and, you know, like hand some, you know, Marcus Garvey's like, literature and writings and stuff. And, you know, so like mob were, exposed to sort of this, you know, outside of Australia thinking from other, you know, like black revolutionaries and radical mob, from around the world as well, you know, through that, you know, union support as well, you know, getting mob, you know, employed, down there in the wharfs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you had it's a really, really interesting story, you know, what you've just started to outline there. You know, in the first instance, in the 1920s, Fred Maynard was the name of one of them, his brother. There were a few of them. They were working on the wharves. And there were black workers working on the wharves in Sydney. And when African, you know, sailors, African-American, Caribbean sailors were coming through the port, they were carrying the literature of the Garvey movement that you described, you know, black power, black pride.
Didn't actually have like a chapter here.
They set up a chapter. That's right. Yeah. So they set up a chapter, and that became the first. Like, obviously, you know, Aboriginal people have had different forms of organisation from before colonisation, but the first sort of formal political organisation, if you like, with like a chair and a secretary and all of that around Aboriginal rights, was formed out of that exact movement. In my research, I've found that unfortunately in the 1920s, when those guys were really building power in their own communities, they had a conference in Kempsey in 1925 of 700 Aboriginal people.
Whoa.
You know, this is incredible when you think there was only actually 6,000 people recognised as Aboriginal by the Welfare Board at that time. There were 700 Aboriginal people in Kempsey at this conference demanding land, an end to the Protection Board, an end to the theft of their children. Unfortunately, at that time, the union movement and even the communists, they were too racist to recognise the importance of this movement. So they didn't really get any support at that time from the union, even though they were unionists themselves, you know.
Mm.
But what they did do was they forced some of the better thinkers in the movement to start thinking about these issues. And so in the 1930s, when there was another wave of Aboriginal struggle with the Australian Aborigines League in Melbourne. William Cooper, mm-hmm. Otis and others, and the Aborigines Progressive Association in Sydney with Patton and Ferguson and others, when that movement came in the 30s, there were people in the unions who responded, and the Communist Party and the left wing of the Labor Party, they did respond. And so there's really, really inspiring stories of the Australian Aborigines League in Melbourne leading the May Day demonstration in the 1930s, through the 1930s. They were the lead float, you know.
Yeah.
And up here in Sydney in the late 1930s, William Ferguson was like one of the main speakers that was advertised for the May Day rally. And the Trades and Labour Council supported the day of mourning that was held in 1938. Just a little lesson from there for me is that, you know, sometimes even when you fight and you don't necessarily break through, you don't necessarily lose, you know, you start ripples that get picked up down the road, you know. So that mob in the 20s who got their politics, obviously from their own communities, but also inspired by this international, you know, black pride, black power movement, they started the ripples that then really did transform, actually, the Labor movement in Australia and the progressive movement in Australia, forcing them to come to terms with the reality of dispossession and racism and start to think about, you know, what they could do to turn it around.
Definitely, you know, and like, you know, those ripples are still continuing today, you know, with people and movements such as, you know, First Nations Workers Alliance, you know, and, you know, I guess other non-Aboriginal groups that not necessarily in the union space as well. I guess, you know, like, well, I guess, how do you see it nowadays, you know, with the support of the union solidarity? Because I know your partner, she's both is, you know, a strong, you know, unionist and that as well, down there in Sydney. Yeah. How do you see it today?
Well, the way I see it is that what's happened to the union movement over the last 30 years in terms of really, really attacking and winding back the capacity of workers to organise, the impacts of that are felt beyond the union movement. So a lot of the actions that were taken in the 1970s, you know, for example, the Builders Labourers Federation refused to develop and knock down the houses that were on the block. And that was a crucial thing in terms of forcing the Whitlam government to actually hand those houses over to the Aboriginal people who were occupying them, you know, because the builders were just like, well, we're not going to knock them down for the developer. So you've got to negotiate with this mob, you know? Mm-hmm. And there were strikes, like unions would go on strike for Aboriginal rights at different times. Like, the power of the union movement has been wound back so much, and there's such oppressive laws now that you wouldn't be able to do that. You'd get fined, you'd go to the commission, you know? So the way I see it is, like, the fight to try and reestablish union power is very important for all the struggles. And I do think that, you know, it's such a weapon against the system to be able to strike. You know, the only thing they care about is profit. That's the only thing they care about. So if you can jam up their profits, you know, you can force them to the table. You can force them to think. Mm. So, you know, I think about how do we build for a situation where, you know, the extreme injustices that, you know, your mom are facing, you know, it's just extreme. Like, it's unbelievable. People need to understand what's going on with the theft of children, the continuing genocide that's going on. Like, we need to make people understand that, and we need to try and create a situation where there is the power to go and strike again. You know, I'd love to see a big strike of all the workers that are currently on the CDP that you mentioned before, you know? Yeah. Like, people, they are. It's a slave-like system. People in the remote areas, they have to work 25 hours a week to get their Centrelink pay. It's on a ration card most of the time, a basic card or healthy welfare card. So it's less than $5 cash an hour people are getting. You know, no occupational health and safety protection, no nothing. And no investment for community development on the terms of the community. Mm. You know, so people are forced into the arms of the mining industry and other things to try and get some resources. So
try and get that steady work.
Just to get something to live. So what I would, you know, what we'd love to see is to build to a situation where they all went on strike, and when they did go on strike, it was actually support. It was support from the broader union movement. There were solidarity strikes, you know. There was fundraising, and there was an appreciation that the demands coming from the communities go beyond just wages and conditions. You know, back in the day of Lingari and the Gurindji, this was a key moment for forcing the left in Australia, the revolutionary movement in Australia, and just workers, the Labor Party even, forcing them to understand that Aboriginal people aren't just after equality. You know, you mob are sovereign people. Mm-hmm. And if we you know, we want to build that understanding, and we want to build the power to be able to push back the system that's bearing down. So, you know, that's what I think we want to build towards. Small steps, you know, signing people up, small little actions, small little rallies, little unique contingents coming along to the black rights rallies and vice versa, making sure there's good black speakers at your union meeting, at your union rally, talking about the situation facing their communities. Mm. All of these small little steps, you know, I think it's important to do to try to rebuild, you know, what was there in the late 60s and early 70s when we were all going forward. Workers were getting better wages, you know, we were getting more power in the workplace. And people were really had land rights seriously on the agenda, you know. They were pushing back and defeating the laws that were on top of them. So, you know, that's what we look to. How do we get that power back? You know, it's a hard slog to try to build it. Yeah,
definitely it is. It is, you know. And I think, you know, over the last, I don't know, 4 to 5 years has sort of been like this resurgence as well, not just, you know, amongst, you know, like Aboriginal issues and that there, but, you know, like you see this, you know, like you only see it, you know, come around once, and, you know, like that's for Invasion Day marches, like, you know, major cities around the country see, you know, thousands upon thousands of people get out and then march in solidarity with Aboriginal people all over this country. Whether or not it's, you know, for the reason of abolishing it or for changing the date, you know, like we do see, like, this symbolic, you know, getting out there and supporting. But, yeah, like you're saying, you know, like, it needs to, you know, be an educated sort of front when it comes to, you know, showing true solidarity. Yeah, not just on one day.
Yeah, absolutely. And doing that, but I agree with you. You know, I reckon the size of the Invasion Day rallies, that does show people are hungry for something different.
Mm.
You know, I think a lot of people are hungry for something different. The other thing, and I'm going to have to go, brother, but just want to make this one point, is just to give a bit of respect to yourself and a lot of the other young, you know, black activists out there, that on the 1st of May, 3 years ago, pulled off one of the most spectacular actions against the closure of remote communities.
Mm.
You know, thousands and thousands of people out on the street. And I think that that shows, again, just what you're saying, like, there is a hunger out there for an alternative. You know, there are people, non-Indigenous people, who look at the situation and they know they're living a lie, you know, with the way Australian nationalism carries on and all the lies and all the racism, you know, and they want an alternative. So, you know, how can we do what we can to try to build that power, build that strength, and make sure those numbers are there and that it deepens and it goes into the workplaces, you know, and it goes into the unions and it goes into the communities. And so, yeah, next time we have a moment like that where you bring all those people out on a major rally like you did on the 1st of May 3 years ago against community closures, you know, wouldn't it be great if we were doing that on a weekday and there were workers on strike?
Mm.
You know, I think it's that sort of thing is going to really frighten the people who rule this country. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, no, I just want to say a big thank you, you know, to our brother here, Paddy, for joining us this morning. You know, for our, you know, May Day, let's talk, you know, exploring the relationships between the union movements and also, you know, our movement, the Aboriginal struggle. You know, it's a very, very important issue to follow and to, you know, I guess put your head around and get to know about. You know, like, we don't ask for people to, you know, I guess, you know, we're not asking for somebody to feel sorry for us. It's actually for people to realize and understand that, you know, the struggle that we're in, you know, we're bound together, and that, you know, it is, you know, for something much more than, you know, what we have on our plates. But yes, you know, big thank you to our brother for joining us this morning.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thanks for the yarn, bro.
You've been tuned to Let's Talk, highlighting the injustice from community to country, suburb to city, with a multitude of hosts, Bo Spearham, Carver Watson and Chelsea Bond. Weekday mornings from 9 till 10, it's Let's Talk, welcoming the continued sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country.